Tony, good morning.
Well, I want to thank everybody for being here. I was trying to come up with a topic for this presentation. I thought, well, I've been an activist and in academia for between 15 to 20 years now, so it's usually about the time you start doing some soul searching about what this was all about and what are our prospects for real change moving forward after you see a lot of different social movements over that period of time. You wonder where we're going. So I want to start out with actually sort of a little bit of an anecdote. I, outside of being a teacher and scholar, I'm also a union activist and organizer. At my college in Central Illinois, I'm on the collective bargaining team for all the faculty there. And it was interesting. We had a recent meeting with the school, with administration, in the collective bargaining process. And apparently, we had found out recently, the faculty there, that we have a board of trustees member who is actually the head of the Donald Trump campaign for Illinois. So that's so interesting. You've got somebody at this public college who's doing this. And there was a little joke at the negotiating table. One of the faculty union reps said, well, we're really, really happy to know, facetiously, of course, that we're going to be so well represented as Donald Trump comes to Springfield to do his speech, which he was coming within like a day or so of the meeting to do that. And on the other side of the table, one of the administration members with a dead serious face looked at us and said, yes, we will be well represented. She was very adamant about that, almost insulted that someone would suggest, how dare you challenge Donald Trump? And this got me thinking about this idea of the useful idiot, the person who parrots statements, and it's not entirely clear that they know that they're part of a bigger sort of neoliberal effort to gut what's left of education, and these are the same people who are voting for Bruce Rauner for governor and then complaining that we don't have any money. Well, why don't we have any money? It's like, well, it's not that complicated, really, if you think about what people did in the state of Illinois and who they voted for. So I always found that kind of fascinating. You've got this sort of false consciousness thing. And so what kind of impediments are we talking about here then for the average American in terms of really coming up with some sort of revolutionary change in this country? And when I say revolutionary, that could mean a lot of different things. It could mean a total revolution in terms of our culture and the way we look at society and the way we look at each other, materialism, questioning, just this idea of sort of mindless consumption. Toward what end? Or total economic changes in terms of U.S. militarism, the political process. There could be a lot of different ways that we would look at revolutionary change. So what are the prospects for this, and what are the problems? Fortunately, we're at a point right now where whatever kind of revolutionary change you're talking about, we're really not anywhere near where we need to be in terms of building some sort of alternative system and even having a vision for doing that. And so my goal was, thinking about this presentation, to try and explain why that is. Now, I'm not totally pessimistic because I think there have been some changes recently that we can build on post-2008, but there are still a lot of things that we need to be clear-eyed about in terms of problems. And until we address these things, I don't know that we're going to be able to really move forward. So why are we not there? I was thinking about it because I interact with 18 to 20-year-olds every day, and I see what's going on in their lives, teaching classes. And so what's going on with a lot of young Americans particularly? One big problem is just that people are extremely apathetic. There's this assumption that, well, they've been socialized mainly through parents, but also through the media and through election ads, that it doesn't matter. There's nothing you're going to be able to do anyways because the whole system is rotten. And this is really quite fascinating because after 9/11, I remember you had this sort of mass effort on the part of Americans to not ask questions. The idea was that government and the president during a time of crisis, they were out to help the average person. So you sort of needed to suspend disbelief. And I remember thinking at the time, well, it's just amazing how many people never ask questions about government. And that was always my goal as an activist during the 2000s, making people think critically. Now, it seems to be the exact opposite problem whenever I run into students. Everybody is cynical and assumes automatically from the beginning that because things are so screwed up, there's absolutely nothing that can be done. So that's an amazing change in a little more than a decade. And I never thought 10 years ago that I would be the person sitting in front of the classroom saying, I need to walk you back from the edge, and maybe it's not the end of civilization as we know it here. I would have thought 10 years ago, well, if I was doing that in a classroom, I would be a horrible, horrible propagandist. But it's gotten to the point where, you know, it's one thing to have critical beliefs, but it's another thing to have critical beliefs that are destructive. You just totally disassociate yourself from society's institutions and from being active and becoming informed. So this is really a big problem, this systemic apathy. Part of the big problem, too, I'm going to talk about later, is I think there's another kind of apathy in modern capitalism, this idea that people have just become co-opted. Reformist capitalism, really starting with the FDR era, moving onward. There are a lot of things that Americans have today. When you look at the average poor person today versus 100 years ago, people have a lot of, the average poor person today has so much more in a lot of ways than someone did previously. So there might be a lot of ways in which people are just sort of being pacified. We talk about modern electronics and modern conveniences. So that's the thing I want to talk about too. And I think maybe most importantly, we just have a fundamental lack of institutions to work toward progressive change. So if only 1 in 10 Americans is part of a labor union, that makes it very difficult to work toward any sort of progressive economic vision without the institutions to mobilize people. So I'm going to start with the good news and then go to the bad news. In terms of the good news, we talk about what we can build on for the average American. What we see today is a systematic, as I had already mentioned, distrust of basic institutions. And you can sort of work with that in the sense that that's really supposed to be the first step to challenging an entire political and economic system. And if you look at a lot of surveys, it's pretty obvious that people do have, I would say, bordering on a radical distrust of basic institutions. So, for example, there was a CBS poll done this year, 2015, and they found that 54% of Americans said that they thought it was true that only a few Americans at the top are the ones that really have a chance to get ahead. So that's more than half of Americans there. 82% of Americans this year, as of last month, October, say they disapprove of Congress. So that's you're at almost record numbers there. In recent years, we've really seen a record high in terms of distrust. Nearly 80% of Americans, as of 2012, said that they feel like government is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, not for the benefit of all Americans. So there's a fundamental feeling there that institutions in society, and government particularly, just don't run well for the average person. About 2/3 of Americans, just under that, in 2012, there was a Pew Research Center survey, and it found that about 2/3 of Americans said, we need labor unions, we do, to protect the average working person. So there is this sort of foundation there, I guess I would say a latent foundation. People really haven't been active to make sure it becomes a reality, but this idea that we should be having collective organizing on the part of workers. Also, 72% in 2012 said, Wall Street makes too much money. In an era of record inequality, Wall Street has too much. And one very common word that comes up in surveys when you ask Americans about rich people is greedy. In surveys, you see that. It's a very strong sentiment that comes through. So 61% said in 2012 corporations make too much profits, too. Presumably, there's some sort of underlying support there for redistribution. You talk about higher corporate taxes and regulations, if we can find a way to do that. 58% of Americans in 2010, according to a CNN poll, said they think that Congress should do more to regulate Wall Street. So we've got a number of different surveys here that suggest that you have a very strong distrust on the part of Americans for basic institutions, for corporations, wanting more government intervention in regulating Wall Street. And we do have, fortunately, some social movements that have been active recently. Whether we're talking about protests in Ferguson and New York City over issues of police brutality, racial profiling, the whole Black Lives Matter campaign in general really is one of these rays of hope that we have seen recently where you could say communities and people are starting to connect basic problems in society. Things like, oh, there's a link between racial segregation and economic inequality, and entire communities in this country that are being left behind and historically have, and people are just getting fed up and tired with it and actually protesting for major changes. The environmental movement would be another big thing recently. when you talk about growing activism, particularly scientists in the United States, but also other activists, and raising attention to global warming and climate change. And I think you'd say that there's always been an environmental movement, but what I've noticed in the last 5 years particularly is with the onset of all the extreme weather and all the scientific studies now that are linking extreme weather to global warming, and the average person making that connection, we've seen in surveys a growing awareness of climate change and global warming, and the average voter saying that they would look down on a political candidate if they didn't take this seriously. So that is something we haven't seen before in terms of people actually translating a belief into a potential action there when it comes to who they're going to vote for. So there is some room for optimism on the environmental front. I think obviously Occupy Wall Street would be a great example of people in the modern economy with all the instability, high unemployment after 2008, coming together and actually demanding that we pay attention to this issue of inequality. And there was certainly some effect there in terms of people starting to talk about the issue more in America. 15 now, really a big thing within the United States in terms of this push for with service workers, whether it be Walmart employees, McDonald's employees, or other service workers, to have an actual living wage. And we're seeing actual movement now in individual cities and states. So this is another one of those areas where there's some, I think, some real optimism. What I have found in my research, now this is looking at national public opinion surveys. Post-2008 does seem to be a dividing point compared to pre-2008 in terms of Americans and their awareness changing. It's not just general survey numbers where you see that people are becoming more critical of corporate power and more concerned about inequality, but something very interesting has happened, and it could be summarized somewhat by the political scientist Ted Robert Gurr. This political scientist, he came up with this theory called relative deprivation. And this sort of plays into Marx here, too. When you talk about relative deprivation, Ted Robert Gurr was interested in under what circumstances people might actually rebel against a political or economic system. And his point with the theory of relative deprivation is that your anger and action is relative to people around you within your individual society. People aren't really so much looking at what's happening in India with poverty or China or elsewhere, but they do notice things in their own communities and states and cities. So people who feel deprived during times of economic crisis and anxiety, based on what they see happening around them, that might actually be a strong catalyst for people to become less apathetic. So the idea with relative deprivation, you have something that you expect. There's a gap between what you expect to happen to you in terms of your economic circumstances and what you think in terms of your skills you're capable of achieving in terms of a career or job opportunities, and the gap between those things and what actually happens in a bad economy. So you feel deprived relative to what you think you should have gotten or could have gotten. This may be an important force in terms of shaking people of their apathy. Now that idea, I would say, relates back to Marx in the sense that you talk about how man makes his own history, but seldom under circumstances of his own choosing. People might become much more vigilant during times of increased economic desperation. And that's something I think is really key to some of the research I'm doing now. What I found is that there are certain economic factors, certain trends, that seem to be systematically linked to people growing more and more angry, particularly decline in gross domestic product, meaning economic growth that is not very good, growing unemployment particularly as well, and the housing market. All three of those things seem to be having a significant impact post-2008. Why are they important? On the one hand, all those things are correlated with people becoming more concerned with the economy in general. There are all these survey questions that different polling organizations ask Americans, and one of them is, what do you think is the most important problem in America? And oftentimes, people say the economy. Those numbers have been going up dramatically post-2008, and they seem to be systematically linked to these three indicators I just talked about, GDP, unemployment, value of the housing market. So people in these increasingly anxious economic times become much more concerned with the economy in general. Now that actually matters in terms of people saying the economy is a really important problem because it's linked to all types of other attitudes that people increasingly form. For example, people accepting this idea that the economy is the most important problem is systematically linked to people becoming more angry at political leaders, becoming more likely post-2008 to say they were extremely unhappy with the Bush administration in general and with corporations, more specifically. Particularly this idea that corporations make too much profit. So economic anxiety seems to translate into an increased vigilance on people's part. Now, I wouldn't say that's the end of it. I've seen some other survey data when you look at the Pew Research Center and other survey groups. What you notice is there are all types of questions that they ask about things like declining quality of life. They ask people, how would you say that your quality of life is today versus 5 years ago? For example, if it was on a ladder from 1 to 10, 1 being poor, 10 being really, really excellent. And they ask people how their quality of life has changed. They ask people if their economic situation has declined, if in general they would say they have poor personal finances. All of these things seem to be linked, on the one hand, to people becoming more conscious of an economic divide, being more likely to say that there is an actual divide in America between haves and have-nots. And a lot of Americans don't actually say that. Most Americans don't think there's a divide. So the idea that as people's finances change and their economic situation changes, they finally wake up to this idea that there are haves and have-nots, that is a significant change in and of itself. I would call this a critical class consciousness. It's not just that you know that there are poor people out there and wealthy people, but you're actually recognizing that there's a fundamental divide in society with record inequality today, especially between haves and have-nots. A very critical way of looking at class, rather than just saying generically, well, there are different classes out there. As people gain that critical class consciousness, that is associated with all types of progressive beliefs and attitudes. That's what we've been seeing in the last 5 to 7 years. People who start embracing the idea that we really are divided are increasingly likely to say, maybe we need to do something about it. They're increasingly likely to favor unions, the idea that we should be joining unions. They're much more pessimistic about the economy in general. They're not likely to accept a lot of the falsehoods they're told in the media about, well, look, unemployment's getting so much better and the economy's recovering. They don't accept those things as much. More sympathetic to poor people in general, less sympathetic to rich individuals. More in favor of regulating corporations, more distrustful of corporations. More likely to support cutting military spending and taking action on things like climate change and global warming. More likely to support strengthening welfare programs. This was really interesting. More likely, in terms of people who have this growing class consciousness, to support socialism. You actually ask that question. The Pew Research Center has asked it a number of times in recent years. What do you think of the idea of socialism versus capitalism? And people becoming more open to that idea in general. Now, unfortunately, with the survey, they just throw these words out there. So what does socialism mean? Does that mean like, well, FDR was in favor of social welfare programs and we have firefighters and police, socialized services? Or do you mean actual socialism in the sense of collective ownership of the means of production? Now, we don't know the answer to that exactly because the survey doesn't ask people. But just the idea in general that people are becoming increasingly open to talking about socialism is an interesting development. So I think that's very relevant in modern times. So we've got some good news here in terms of what's been going on in recent years and what changes we might be able to work toward. Now, unfortunately, for all the good news, there's an awful lot of bad news, too. So I don't think that it really helps for us to be overly optimistic. What I've noticed in my 10 years of teaching and my 15 to 20 years of activism, unfortunately, it seems like a lot of Americans really have an extremely infantile understanding of the political process. Just fundamental misinformation, ignorance, sort of like the Homer Simpson moment when you want to smack your forehead with your palm and yell, "Doh!" This problem. False beliefs. I gave you an anecdote at the beginning of the presentation. That's just an anecdote, of course, but if we look across the board, you would say corporatists in America and American elites, economic elites, have been very busy in recent decades creating all types of false consciousness. You have an army of people out there, whether it be political leaders or people in the mass media, particularly talk radio and Fox News, but also other media outlets too, who have been selling, to put it bluntly, three things: loud, angry, and stupid. It doesn't give me any pleasure to say that as an academic, but when you look at a lot of public opinion surveys, and particularly when you look at the Republican Party candidates this time around, you have an active contempt for any sort of effort to have evidence-based reasoning. People who just say things over and over and over that are blatantly false. Ben Carson is convinced that the pyramids were for Joseph's golden grain. And when people asked him about that, he said, "Well, one opinion's as good as another. Other people think it was aliens. I personally disagree." I say, well, that's wonderful. So you saw some bogus History Channel documentary about aliens and the pharaohs. And, oh, that's just as good as Joseph's golden grains. Well, what aren't there like these people out there? Oh, yeah, there are these archaeologists, and they study things, and they study hieroglyphs, and they have actual evidence, and they look at the history of Egypt, and they know that these things had to do with pharaohs and slave labor, and deification of human beings. And no, don't worry about any of that stuff, you know, because anybody can say whatever the hell they want. And nobody's going to be called out on it. And if somebody is called out on it in a debate, the candidates all gang up together and say, "You guys are mean." The moderator, "Oh, you guys are anti-Republican because you have this silly commitment to correcting blatant falsehoods and asking questions about it." So this is a really big problem when you have this kind of commentary and cultural discourse in the United States. It makes it hard to have real arguments and use actual evidence. How do you argue with people who are socialized to not believe in evidence-based reasoning? There's a saying a fellow faculty of mine likes to use, and he didn't come up with it. It goes back to paraphrasing Mark Twain. He said, "Don't argue with idiots because they'll drag you down to their level, and then they'll beat you with experience." So how do you deal with that problem? You don't want to engage in these insane discussions, but that's sort of the position that you find yourself in. And we don't really need to look any further than the front runner in the Republican side right now, Donald Trump. You could say him and Ben Carson are neck and neck. So we've already talked about him a little bit. So we know some of the issues there. But if you look at Donald Trump, this idea of a completely reactionary, corporatist agenda mixed with virulent racism, xenophobia, these false sort of pandering to working class Americans, particularly in Iowa. If you take a close look at how Trump is polling right now, you compare his numbers to, let's say, Hillary Clinton. Now, I'm no defender of the Democratic Party, but I think if you had a paper bag going up against Donald Trump, the paper bag should be 20 points up. With how ridiculous some of the things that Donald Trump has said are and how embarrassing they are, to be honest. But no, you look at Trump versus Clinton. People are asked in a hypothetical election today, if these two are running against each other, who would you vote for? The numbers right now are 43% Trump, 47% Clinton. That's a 4% margin there. And keep in mind, in surveys, there's a 2 to 3% margin of error. Remember that, too, when you look at these. So technically, the numbers could be neck and neck within the margin of error. Why is this even a competition? Again, I'm not going to sit here and romanticize Democrats, but I think, again, the paper bag should be up 20 points up. Why is this happening? You could say, well, Hillary Clinton is a soulless hack of a Democrat. So people don't like her. Fine. How do we explain when you look at surveys of Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders? Now, you can say what you want about Bernie Sanders, but he is a progressive candidate, and he does say a lot of the right things when you talk about inequality and concern with regulating corporations, even if there are a lot of troubling things there in terms of militarism. He's an actual progressive candidate of the FDR sort of variety, and that is different than a centrist sort of corporatist Democrat of the Clinton-Obama variety. You look at these numbers between them. There's an actual difference there. Hillary Clinton polls at 56% public support. Bernie Sanders, 31%. He's not a minor candidate in the media. Gets a lot of attention. How are these numbers so far apart? I really can't chalk this up to much more than people fundamentally not taking the time to actually look into candidates and actually think about these things in a way in which they can assess a candidate as related to what that candidate could do to actually help their lives, and do this in an informed way. So you have these almost insane situations like this. For example, if you look at congressional races, they have a hypothetical races where they ask people across the country, who would you prefer to have as the majority in the House and Senate coming up in the next election? Democrats or Republicans? Now, again, this is not a vote of confidence for Democrats, so much it is damning the fact that there are so many people out there who say, yeah, well, the Republican Party, that's not so bad. They would maybe do a really good job of helping the average person. The numbers are 45-45 in terms of which party people would say they would prefer to be the majority in the House and Senate. It's an even split, 45-45. You look closer at these candidates, like the Trumps of the world. What is his platform, if any? Can you find anything? He's been incredibly vague about half of the things that he's talked about, and yet he seems to be this front-running candidate that so many people love. Well, we know he wants a wall, so he's got the xenophobia thing down. And he's not going to pay for it. Mexicans are going to pay for it, right? And what's the problem with Mexican-Americans? According to Donald Trump, well, I'm sure you've all heard the speech, or at least the excerpts from it. The problem with Mexicans is that, and he's talking in like a universalistic way here, right? They're rapists and drug addicts and criminals. And then he corrects himself. Well, excuse me, they're not all rapists and drug addicts and criminals. And then he says in an interview with Rosie O'Donnell, I like Jews because Jews can count money, not blacks who are lazy. I wouldn't trust them with my money. So you look at these situations and you say, and this is your front runner candidate. How do you get elected in a country where you actively go out of your way to insult entire races of people and a third of the entire population? And yet, this candidate is a front runner. Despite these things that are all on record, they're out there, there's no question about it. I remember talking with a bunch of students about this recently, and I pointed these things out. And they said, I didn't know any of that. I said, well, that's what happens when you don't pay attention to who the candidates are. What else is going on with this candidate, with Trump? Well, he actually has said some things about tax policy. We should have zero corporate taxes. We should repeal the entire estate tax and lower income taxes, which by their nature, the way it's set up today, are progressive, which means even more tax cuts for affluent, wealthy people if you're going to cut the federal income tax. Ground troops in Iraq. So this is basically Bush Part 2 then, right? Ground troops in Iraq, massive cuts in corporate taxes, global warming. That's a fraud. It's all made up. That's another part of his platform. Interestingly, he says one thing that you could say, well, he's covered his base here in terms of not scaring off some of the typical Republican Party voters, elderly, white males particularly, and females too. I will not cut Social Security and Medicare, he says. That's all that they have to hear. Oh, well, Medicare and Social Security, well, as long as he's down with supporting those, then we'll be okay. Well, how do you keep those programs going when you don't have any tax revenues? Can you ask a basic, logical question there? How are you going to do that? Oh, he's given an answer, by the way, recently. PBS reported this. He said, well, with all the massive tax cuts, there will be such fabulous economic growth that we'll have more tax revenues. And through growing the economy, we'll come up with additional tax revenues, as if this hasn't been tried multiple times under the Reagan administration. The Laffer Curve, the Bush administration. These promises are decades old. These aren't new ideas. These things have been tried many times and have failed miserably. And if you had some basic economic literacy in this country, people would laugh these ideas out of the room. And yet people sit there and they, with a straight face, say, yeah, Donald Trump sounds pretty good. I mean, these things are utterly insane if you think about it from an evidence-based point of view and what we've actually seen happen in recent decades. I think it's really interesting when you look at who people actually vote for. I looked at the 2012 numbers recently. I actually hadn't looked at them until just now. 38% of Americans who make under $50,000 a year voted for Mitt Romney. That's almost 40%. People who made between $50,000 and $100,000 a year, 52% of them voted for Mitt Romney. You're getting an interesting group there when you talk about people making $50,000 to $100,000 a year. Hardly elite. Maybe somebody making $100,000 a year is middle upper class, maybe. Interesting how when you look at a lot of Americans, you get a little something for yourself going. A little something. You're not rich, not by any means. Maybe over the period of 20 years of a career, you've managed to work yourself up as a family income up to $100,000. Now you're the next Donald Trump, right? This is the faux elite phenomenon. They think they're an elite. They're not an elite. You're very far from it. You're going to vote for the same people who are going to gut your Medicare and Social Security benefits and any other benefits that you might need. But they're convinced that they're the next Donald Trump. You make $100,000 a year, you're going to compare yourself to a billionaire and identify with him when it comes to voting. And it's even more disturbing, as I had mentioned, if you're under that, you're under $50,000 a year and you're voting for a Republican candidate. Well, if you look at people under $50,000 a year, you could also say, well, on the other hand, more than 60% of them are voting for a relatively less conservative candidate if they vote Democratic, so a lot of these people aren't blatantly ridiculous in their mindset, although I'm not, again, going to say Democrats are some sort of messiah for the average person. But what you'll notice when you look at poorer Americans is a second big problem is they don't turn out to vote at all. So you've got massive numbers of people that if they actually turned out and actually voted for progressive political candidates, maybe if a lot of these people voted for actual third-party candidates, there could be some sort of actual movement on the left in America towards realizing some of these ideas we've been talking about, some of these progressive visions. But people don't turn out to vote. People who make between $20,000 and $40,000 a year, less than half of them turn out to vote. Whereas if you look at people making $100,000 a year, $200,000 a year or more, the range is between 80 to 100% voter turnout. So you have a massively oversized influence on government because you actually turn out and participate. Whereas the people who are oftentimes the most progressive in terms of their ideas, again, these people who have been on the losing end of the economic divide in recent years, and they become more polarized recently, as I talked about, they're not turning out to participate. Now, they are in some ways, if you talk about the 15 Now movement and Occupy Wall Street, but again, we're really nowhere near some sort of revolutionary change in mindset for the average American. This is where it gets really frustrating. For all those numbers I gave you before, where I talked about how people think that corporations have too much power, they make too much profit, people disapproving of Congress, people feeling the whole system is run for the few, we can find just as many survey questions that make you want to scratch your head and say, huh? When you look at the average American and their opinions about economics. For example, 60% of Americans, according to a Pew Research Center poll in recent years, in the last couple years, said, if you simply work hard enough, you'll succeed and get ahead. 60% of Americans say that that's true. Now, if you think about it realistically and you look at trends for the last 40 years, you would know the exact opposite of that is true. The average male worker has seen about a 25 to 30% decline in their income. The average family is working a third longer than they used to. Much more productive. Worker productivity has gone up dramatically. So the average person has seen their income stagnate to decline for the average family, while people are working a lot harder. So in other words, people have been working harder and they've been falling behind. And yet 60% of Americans think the opposite is true. Well, why? You go to college, you get a degree, and you make more money later than you did earlier in your life. Wow, I'm getting ahead. You don't compare yourself to somebody who was in that same situation 20 or 30 years earlier who didn't need to go borrow $50,000 to $100,000 to get a degree to get a decent job.
They didn't even go to college necessarily.
Right. They didn't. Maybe they could get a job out of high school. A factory job or some other kind of job. They didn't have to borrow any money. Or some sort of technical training for 2 years, and college tuition was far less. So people don't compare themselves to somebody 30, 40 years ago. They compare themselves to themselves a few years earlier. They don't see the broader economic context. They say, I'm working harder and I'm doing better. Not really. Not if you have any sort of historical understanding at all. You're much worse off. 58% of Americans in 2011, the last time this was surveyed, according to the Pew Research Center, 58% said there is no economic divide in America between haves and have-nots. Who are these have-nots you speak of? We have haves and have-mores. Everyone's a have. If you look at people's own identification with a class, if you ask them, what class are you a part of? 90% say some variant of middle class. They say either lower middle class or straight middle class or upper middle class. 90% of Americans. So everyone is middle class. You can talk to people who make $1 million a year, $10 million a year. Almost nobody in America, including wealthy people, will say that they're upper class. 1% of Americans say they're upper class. In the wealthiest country in the human history, 1% of people are upper class? My ass! That's insane to think that. But we know from studies that the average wealthy person in America, the average affluent person, way underestimates their class status. And on the other side, when you talk about poor Americans, they way overestimate their class status. Nobody wants to say that they're lower class. It's only about 8 to 9% of Americans who will actually say that in a survey. I found a fascinating statistic looking at family household incomes from the survey done by the Pew Research Center a couple years ago. They found that if you looked at families who said their income was less than $10,000 a year. Now, you are objectively poor, according to the federal government's own poverty guidelines, which we know are horribly pathetic and underestimates. For example, according to those guidelines, the average family of four that makes $23,500 a year is not poor. You think about that for a second. You wouldn't be considered poor. At 23.5, so they're horribly underestimating actual poverty levels. If you actually reestimated it and said poverty would be 1.5 times that, so somebody making in the mid-30s to closer to 40, if that's actual poverty, it's about a third of Americans today. You could make an easy argument that about a third of Americans are in poverty today if you recalibrated that poverty definition. Now, forget about them for a minute. If you go back and look at that group, that 10,000 or less group of Americans, two-thirds of these people say they're not lower class. You think that I'm lower class? How dare you? I'm lower middle class. You got to throw that middle in there, right? You've got to cling to that idea that everybody here is equal. We're all equal. There's the haves and the have-mores. Well, it's going to be hard to really mobilize any sort of revolutionary change in society when you have this much delusion among a lot of the masses of Americans. Now, I saw some numbers recently, and I usually go over these with my students. Quite disturbing numbers, actually, in terms of recent polls. When you talk about the idea of mass public ignorance, in 2010, 55% of voters and 67% of Republican voters were convinced that Obama was a socialist when they were surveyed. Now, Obama has never at any point in his life articulated that he believes in the idea of socialism. He's never advocated for government ownership of industries or worker ownership of industries. So where does this come from? Well, people on Fox News and Republican candidates scream about secret socialism in America, and people accept it. That same year, 25% of Republicans in this country thought Obama was literally the Antichrist on Earth. 25% of Republican Americans, 13% of all Americans thought that. 13% thought he was the Antichrist on Earth, and another 13% just couldn't be sure. That Obama, he's slick. He might be the Antichrist. We don't know about that guy. We got to watch him. That's a quarter of Americans. I still haven't figured out over all the years how to wrap my head around that statistic. But actually, they get worse. If you look at some of the other surveys out there. In 2010, that same year, 4 in 10 Republicans were convinced that Obama was, quote, doing many things Hitler did. Well, I guess that's true. Hitler had roads, there were taxes, programs of different kinds, highways. Is this a fair comparison? There's an old saying, you know, when you have to bring Hitler into the mix in terms of your argument, you've automatically conceded that you've lost because now you're dealing purely with emotion here. Now, maybe I missed the story. Maybe I'm just wrong, but I'm pretty sure I didn't see the one in the news where Obama signed an order and collected 6 million Republicans and sent them to the gas chambers. Maybe I missed it. I don't think so. And yet, 4 in 10 Republicans were convinced of this, doing many things Hitler did. Lots of things we could compare them with, right? Taxes, roads, eggs. Well, we're getting to more serious territory there, sure. This was fascinating. 2006, 63% of Americans couldn't find the country of Iraq on a map. The country we had become convinced by our president that we were liberating, and people got really amped up and worked up about it after 9/11. They said, we're going to liberate the hell out of these people. Right? Two-thirds to three-quarters of Americans were on board by the time the invasion happened. Little problem. We can't find it. We'd liberate the hell out of it if we could find it. We don't know where it is. Another funny saying about Americans, war is their way of learning geography. But apparently that's not even true anymore, because we were at war with Iraq and people still couldn't find it. They didn't know where Iraq was. 43% that same year couldn't find the state of New York on a map. They didn't know where that was either. Just last year, there was a science survey done, found that 1 in 4 Americans did not know that the Earth revolves around the sun. 1 in 4. Well, the science is still out, like global warming, right? Yeah, maybe they thought that.
Yeah, it's nostalgia for the Middle Ages.
We're going back to that level of knowledge at that point. A fundamental failure of educational institutions.
No, it's a success.
It's a success? How would we
utter
call it a success?
That's
the
success.
If you're fundamentally unable to think in rational ways, I think realistically that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a system in which people can't challenge the political and economic status quo. I think if you look at some of those numbers I talked about earlier in the presentation, people have some sort of vague sense of unhappiness. They distrust most institutions. They're angry, but easily led astray because they're not paying enough attention and taking the time to actually think through what their ideas are and recognize misinformation, and they don't get a lot of help from the mass media or educational institutions. And you've got blatant propaganda masquerading as debate when you talk about political rhetoric as well. So these are a lot of the problems people are facing. I think a lot of the problem with Americans today is people have been pacified by what I would call, for lack of a better word, toys. It's really incredible if you look at the last 10 years, what a change there's been in terms of access to modern conveniences. When I say toys, I'll give you some statistics here. Between 2005 and 2014, the average cost of clothing in America went down 20%. Cell phone plans, 35%. They went down in cost. Actual toys for children, 60% decline in cost on average. Cell phones, 60%. PCs, 90% decline in costs. TVs, 110% decline in cost. You can be today the king of a mountain of shit. You can go to the pawn shop and buy 100 DVDs for nothing on what you might get. Let's say you get a little bit of money for Christmas or for a birthday. You've got a ton of junk. Interestingly enough, these same individuals can't pay for their health care or education. Those things have gone up in cost in the last 10 years. These numbers I'm spouting, these are from the New York Times. They did a study of this recently. They pointed out that all these toys and things that divert people's attention away from reality, you know, you're looking at your phone all day long or the television, you're not paying attention to what's happening around you. Those things all went down dramatically in cost. Tuition went up in that same time period for college, 40%. Childcare went up 20%, healthcare 15%, food 5%. So basic necessities or very near necessities went up in cost. People found themselves increasingly struggling, and they seemed to be getting their attention diverted by the declining cost of these toys and conveniences. So the average American might think that they're living better in a lot of ways because of conveniences, but actually, they're much worse off economically in general because of things like growing household debt, growing work hours, declining pay, all of those things combined, and declining health with the obesity epidemic in America as well. So one of the big problems is, you know, when people have been around long enough, they're told about this American dream. People accept it for a long time, and it just doesn't happen economically, and they find themselves working harder for less, and people feel like a failure because the system has failed. people, but they internalize it with the very individualistic culture we have in the United States, where people are told, if you can't get a job, it's your fault because you're lazy. So you borrow tens of thousands of dollars. The average student borrows more than $30,000 in student loan debt. The average parents borrow almost as much. And for what? This is a very common thing that Robert Hughes is talking about here, where I would see people routinely after college graduating the bachelor's degree, 6 months later you see them working at Best Buy. Say, what was the point of that? You could have got that job out of high school. You could have got that job in high school. So what was that for? People say the unemployment rate is returned to the level it was pre-2008. Have the quality of jobs returned? That's a different story. The average family today, since the 2008 economic crash, has lost between, depending on the numbers you look at, 40 to 50% of their household wealth. People are far worse off. Earnings have gone down dramatically for the average family from 2008 to 2015. So people are much worse off as an individual economically. So how does this all come together in the end? I'm trying to come up with some concluding points here. I was thinking about this. What is the hope for the future in terms of Americans joining together en masse to actually challenge the political and economic status quo and to change our values fundamentally? I think, it doesn't make me happy to say this, but I think the old proverb, necessity is the mother of invention, is relevant here. A lot of Americans, if you look at our situation relative to not quite 100 years ago, but you go back to the Great Depression, what's our situation versus theirs? Well, today unemployment is 5% with lots of bad jobs. Okay, that's not good, but how does that compare to the Great Depression when you're talking about 25% unemployment and 25% underemployment? 50% of Americans were economically insecure. If you look at numbers for unemployment and underemployment today, you're talking about probably more like 10 to 15%, depending on the year you're looking at, for unemployment and underemployment. Radically different. Well, in radically different situations, in one situation people were far more desperate, people are far more likely to become vigilant when they're desperate. Whether you're talking about during the Great Depression, food riots, which were commonplace in America, industrial strikes and conflicts between labor unions and the National Guard across the country, mass unionism, people joining together to actually form unions and fight for those things. It's sad to say, but we may be at that point right now where people just aren't desperate enough. They've been bought off with a lot of modern conveniences. They've been bought off by a system that has been reformed over time, particularly if you look at the last 10 to 20 years in modern conveniences and people being co-opted and pacified. And also, there's this problem of just not having the institutions necessary. They need to be rebuilt. We talk about labor unions. 10% isn't going to cut it. You're not going to build a mass movement in a country around worker solidarity and worker empowerment when only 1 in 10 workers is in a union. So this is something that's going to have to change. If we want to have a real working class consciousness among Americans, people have to organize. And when is that going to happen? We've seen some organizing. A lot of it, post-2008, is related to what I've been talking about. Worsening economic circumstances, galvanizing people to action. People aren't as desperate as they could be and have been historically when people did far greater things in terms of mobilizing. So I think that's sort of where we're at right now. The optimist in me and the activist in me wants to say, well, that's not true, because if people just roll up their sleeves and get to work, we can change these things soon. But it has that happened. We've been looking at decade after decade of growing insecurity, but over a very long period of time, incrementally, people were becoming more insecure. Short of people getting more desperate, I don't know what's going to happen. I think if you look at one of the areas recently where there's finally been some real pressure for change and we're finally starting to see governments take some sort of action with global warming. Now, it's nowhere near enough if you look at the average wealthy country and how much renewable energy they actually use. It's nowhere near enough. They're going to have to spend far more money on a transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy to combat global warming. But you would say this is one of the few issues where this has happened. But on this issue, finally, in the last 5 years, you've seen Americans increasingly becoming radicalized about the idea of global warming. Why? It wasn't because of the media. You had a systematic campaign for more than half a decade, going from the late 2000s onward, where fossil fuel companies, knowing that global warming was real, lied to people and funded all types of fake studies and fake institutes that got into the news, created fake scandals, like the East Anglia University scandal that wasn't a scandal, but supposedly climate change researchers made all this up even though they didn't. And that position was winning the day for years. If you look at public opinion and the decline in people recognizing that global warming was real in the late 2000s, it was palpable. It was a significant decline. The fossil fuel industry was winning that battle. With the rise of extreme weather in the last 5 years, it's totally changed. You look at the Americans today, and they've been surveyed on this. More than 80% of Americans have said that they've experienced an extreme weather event, whether it be crop wilting, drought, flooding, whatever it is. And they've said they've experienced this, number one. And number two, this in particular has made them much more likely to recognize that there's a real problem. And it overlaps with what scientists have been saying. There's a whole field of research now called attribution research that says that it's not the case that every extreme weather event is caused by global warming, but the likelihood of those events occurring goes up dramatically as the globe gets warmer. So scientists have made this connection for a while now. People are starting to make that connection. I don't think the average person would have made that connection, to be honest, until they started experiencing these things. And as it became a greater concern based on people's actual experiences. So this would be yet another example here, whether you're talking about economics or global warming. People have to deal with a problem, and then a problem starts to become severe, and then they become open to addressing it. That brings us back to Marx again, too. He said, people make their own history. Sure, men make their own history, but seldom under circumstances of their own choosing. So I'll leave people with that quote. I think there's a lot of work to do moving forward, but we're facing some real structural limitations on what can be done in this country, short of things getting worse economically. So thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. Well, thanks for the points. I don't know how much we are apart, to be honest, in terms of the way I'm looking at it. I mean, you had mentioned that we're far from revolutionary change, and I agree completely. And I think at the beginning I had mentioned I'm somewhat optimistic because I think that there's a lot of distrust out there and anger, and people are becoming more desperate. But I think that the problem is that we're really nowhere near channeling any of that stuff. So I would say some optimism, but in general, I would gravitate toward what you're saying.
Thank you.
That we're not near that. Am I being too optimistic by saying that there's some optimism? Well, we gotta have some sort of hope, otherwise we should all just go home and, you know, pick up some beers and do something else. I still have some hope that we're gonna, as things get worse in the United States, there might be an ability of average people to turn things around as they become more and more desperate. Now, the problem with the economic, with the environmental changes is that gonna come too late? You know, there's too much damage too quickly, and I don't have an answer for that. That may very well be the case, but I think from what you said and from what I'm saying here, I think it's really more of a question of degree in terms of how pessimistic both of us have been in terms of my comments versus yours. So I think in terms of the general ballpark of your argument, I think we're pretty much in that same sphere there. The question being, how do I feel about European politics versus in the United States?
Comparison.
I don't specialize in European politics, but from what I am aware of in terms of just generally following the news, I mean, it seems like in general, and from looking at surveys across countries, if you were to compare the average American to a number of, well, depending on which country you're looking at, people seem to be a lot more class conscious. They have a stronger critical class consciousness. They're more likely to be vigilant and mobilized and actually care more about political issues and community issues. I noticed that not just in terms of national surveys, but in terms of a lot of students that I talk to who are exchange students and foreign students, that they seem to be oftentimes more interested even in American politics than a lot of the native students. So I would say in general that, you know, they seem to be more with it in terms of their class consciousness. It is within the bounds of a capitalistic system, of course, and a more of a reform-oriented system, but one with more of a human face in terms of more generous welfare benefits. So it's not radically out of line with the United States, but definitely people are more active, more critical. Well, being familiar with the problems that you describe about elite theory, the political science research on that, between Page and Gillens, this idea that the average person doesn't have much of a say, the idea of government getting captured by corporate interests, all the problems with the average American in terms of quality of life, I guess I would be more depressed if I had been hearing these things for the first time. But since I'm already really familiar with them, it's less depressing. I think one thing that, if we have any hope that things can be improved as a society, and if we want to have revolutionary changes, I guess we really just have to sort of actively reject what you were describing in terms of people who say, well, I don't want to talk about it, and I don't want to hear about it. And the thing that I oftentimes say to my students is, well, look, if you think things can't be worse, then you're out of your mind. Because you think the United States is the worst country in the world in terms of quality of living, level of stability and safety. I mean, things can always be worse. So until people start becoming active, things will keep getting worse. Unless they're willing to understand that point, there's really not much we can do. You can't force somebody to try and make change. But I think they need to understand that point, because a lot of them are convinced coming in, a lot of young Americans, well, there's nothing we can do, and it's all just bad, and it's all screwed up. But obviously, things can always be worse. Things could get better as a society if people organize together. And to be honest, I think a lot of this is skin deep for the average young American. I think they've been told that by their parents, and it's a bunch of cliches and stereotypes. And when I talk about the history of social movements in America in class, people do realize that there are people out there who have overcome really huge obstacles in terms of denial of equal rights based on race, sexual orientation, the union movement, and so on. And they say, wow, there are actually things people could do. I didn't know that. Well, we have to challenge that as educators. So I try to be somewhat optimistic in class, if for no other reason than to walk people off the ledge. Because otherwise, they're just going to come out of there worse than when they came in and say, well, my teacher told me himself, nothing can be done. I may as well become an insurance agent at that point. I can make more money, at least. I think you brought up a lot of great points that I would agree with in terms of the common theme, which is ecological disaster, really. Whether it be nuclear disasters, Fukushima, or global warming, or the plastic crisis, or genetically modified crops. And unfortunately, for a lot of these issues, when I talk to a lot of young Americans, they're not even aware outside of vaguely what a GMO even is. Or the history of nuclear power, or a lot of those things. So obviously we have a lot of work to do as intellectuals for the people out there who are concerned with educating people. It seems to be, unfortunately, I guess this is where I'm going to be a little bit more pessimistic, a losing battle with the modern media because of the dramatic changes that have happened in recent decades, whereas, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, if people wanted to watch television at 5, 6 p.m., they were going to see at least the news. Even if it was corporate news, they would see news. And you don't have to do that anymore. So what you've really done there is you've put that much more pressure on educators to make up the slack. And unfortunately, the way that many educators get socialized in terms of professional norms, if you could call them professional, is to avoid controversy. So if educators aren't doing it and the media aren't doing it, then how do people become informed? It's really an uphill battle. I think at a certain point, the stink just gets so bad that a lot of educators are going to have to say the hell with it. I know what people say I've been trained to do, but I'm not going to sit and tolerate blatant falsehoods and things promoted to students. So more people need to do that. So you raised a good question about and a good point about what's happening in educational institutions, particularly with indoctrination and with suppressing dissent, and particularly related to the Salida case. I mean, if you're asking me my own take on it, I don't know why it had to be controversial that you had someone on their Twitter feed taking stances on on prominent issues and condemning things like murder or a religious system that gets used regularly to justify treating people differently based on ethnicity and race and religion. I think that whether you agree with someone or not, people should be commended for being more active. Now, the problem is that that's not how university administrators see it, and that's the kind of intellectual climate they create in universities where people are scared because of things like this to say things. So a lot of people said, well, Stephen Salida got $600,000 settlement. Well, I guess that's a small win for Stephen Salida and a huge loss for freedom of speech, because all you had to do was spend $600,000 to destroy the integrity of a tenure system for a major flagship university, because he's not there anymore. So you've sent a very nasty message there that, well, freedom of speech is great unless you say something controversial that someone doesn't like. And in this case, he wasn't advocating for Nazism. I mean, okay, if you're advocating for lynching black people or for gas chambers, that's one thing, but you know, murdering other people, but he's talking about not murdering other people. So it's unfortunate. It's one of those things when you talk about educators where I think the big problem is people play the game for so long between undergraduate and graduate school and getting tenure that by the time they get to the point where they're economically secure in their job, there's nothing left of their thoughts. They don't have anything interesting left to say because they've been suppressing it for so long. Or maybe they never had much to say to begin with and they never learned how to say things critically. So the people in the strongest positions to challenge these things are oftentimes people who don't do anything. Now, in general, there still is a strong commitment on the part of tenured faculty to tenure, so you did see some sort of backlash there. But the fact that somebody could be picked on so easily also suggests that, you know, there's not a strong commitment to freedom of speech in higher education. I mean, it's a real fundamental problem that you're speaking of. For me, what you're talking about in terms of asking about how to expand on neoliberalism, I think you're talking about a fundamental assault on two types of rights at least. And there could be others too. We could be talking about environmental rights, right to a safe environment, those kinds of things, but at the very least, some basic political and economic rights. So the idea with political rights, things like freedom of speech, right to privacy, particularly freedom of speech, what has been a big problem in higher education today is the complete instrumentalization of higher education. This idea that we're here to get degrees for jobs, and this whole idea of things like freedom of speech and freedom of thought gets left by the wayside. Those are basic political freedoms and rights. We're supposed to be guaranteed under the Constitution. The Supreme Court has been very clear that those things are guaranteed in higher education until they're denied and people don't fight it. And then economic rights, of course, right to things like stable income, a job, right to food, right to shelter. Those are principles that have been around for a long time. Both of those things, whether it be political, the notion of political rights or economic rights, have been under assault with neoliberalism across the world. So I would define it simply as the rise of private power and complete lack of accountability in terms of society's institutions and basic protections. And I think that's a part of it, what you're talking about. This idea that education is nothing more than making jobs and people need to shut up and get degrees out. And, you know, people who make these kinds of comments like Stephen Salida and raise controversies, well, they need to be filtered out. That's obviously a very dangerous thing that's happening. It has been happening for a long time. It's not the first case. The thing that I'm being left with mostly based on your comments is the issue of faith-based reasoning, if you could call it reasoning in the cases you're talking about. I am not a religious person personally, so I believe in evidence-based reasoning. I think one of the issues in modern America is that the churches are one of the few places left where there are actual institutions that people organize around, and if that could somehow be used to the advantage of progressive causes, that would be great, but I'm not sure if that's possible under the modern context. My family's a Catholic family background, and what I've noticed in the American context in Catholic churches is people go there and wear clothing and compare clothing, and they sit there and listen to a homily, and they utter some things, and then they go home and feel better about themselves. If you could find a way in those kind of settings, because those institutions are there and communities are coming together to push for progressive causes, that would be great. I think it would be a really difficult thing to do, especially if you're talking about born-again evangelical churches and right-wing churches and, you know, the Mormon church, because they're so reactionary. I don't know that there's any room there to do those things. There might be some room in other denominations. It's going to be an uphill battle because I've, you know, most religious institutions try and avoid being openly advocating anything. And if those institutions are going to have social value, I think they need to start sticking up for real causes. I mean, I appreciate the comments about community-based activism. I think one thing I try and impress to my students is to get them to think and be more self-conscious about where their identity comes from. And we talk a lot about consumerism. And I give them hypothetical scenarios about what would you do on an ideal weekend? And I give them the consumer item-based approaches versus community-based approaches. And very rarely do people pick community-based activities. And, you know, I mean, I guess the first goal would be getting people to fundamentally reconsider what it is they define as their identity and why they don't define themselves based on community. Because short of having that, you know, without community-based organizing, nothing can happen. So I think that's one of the fundamental building blocks that we need to focus on. I appreciate all your comments, and I was trying to sort of figure out at the beginning of this how to complain about people embracing the Republican Party while not sounding like I'm endorsing the Democratic Party, and that's a very difficult thing to do. I'm not a Democrat, never have been. I thought, well, if I drew on Marx enough, people would know that where I'm coming from here. And I guess I would say to try and clarify, you know, maybe I didn't do a good enough job of it at the beginning of the talk. It doesn't impress me at all if someone says they vote for the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party today is what the Republican Party was 40 years ago. So that's what it is, and we all know that's what it is, and it's, you know, the slightly less rancid version of the other rancid party. But I can still say, I think, in this day and age that, you know, while it doesn't impress me that half of Americans vote for Democrats, I find it extraordinarily disturbing that people would so openly embrace this other party, which is so blatantly racist and homophobic and anti the average American in terms of, you know, basic benefits and programs. So I think that's the part I'm trying to focus more on, that how can people not see that so blatantly? A lot of people fall victim to the Democratic propaganda and the rhetoric about caring about the average person. So you can sort of see why they're voting that way, even though it's not productive. But the other stuff is just so blatantly obvious. I mean, when you have these comments like administrators saying that Donald Trump is great, you just, how are we affiliated with the same institution? I mean, it's so blatantly ridiculous, the things that come out of his mouth. And I think the average person, you know, if they can't cut through the smooth-talking Democratic propaganda, should at least be able to recognize the obvious bullshit being promoted within the Republican Party. At least that would be a start to sort of moving towards something better. And we're not seeing that even. So I'll leave it at that.
All right, then. Thank you very much.